The official Vintage Guitar Magazine Price Guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.
Hello, and welcome to Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. I'm your host, Ram Tooley. This podcast is about the joy of guitar. That includes buying guitars, selling guitars, collecting guitars. We're talking vintage guitars, new guitars, used guitars, pre-war, flat tops, electric Spanish arch tops, custom shop guitars, limited edition guitars, basses, amps, effect pedals, lap steels, mandolins, banjo. If it has strings, we're going to talk about it. I spend most of my life studying the vintage guitar market. It's truly something I love and I'm passionate about. I can talk guitars all day, and I'm going to. Welcome to another thrilling edition of Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. Today, I'm joined by one of the most important figures in the history of vintage guitar business, George Groon. For more than five decades, George has been at the forefront of this business, and I am thrilled to finally have him on this podcast. How are you, George?
Well, I'm doing fine today. It's a weird world out there.
It is. Long before I worked at the Vintage Guitar Magazine Price Guide, you helped me with many of my books. The last time we met, I came into your store. I wanted to buy a D28. We sat together for hours. You heard me play, you shook your head, and you said, that wasn't the guitar for me. And I went home with a 1931 OM28.
Well,
that was the guitar for me, for sure.
Yeah, different guitars have different personalities, different voices, and respond to a different touch. And often enough, people come in asking for what they've been told they should want, but if I listen to them, I can tell pretty well what they really need.
Yeah. And I was, I think you said my style was not a dreadnought style. I was a bluesy guy. And you said, no, you're a triple O or an OM. So I said, yep, you are correct.
That's true of electrics, acoustics, and all sorts of things. And same is true for mandolins and banjos. Not everybody has the same touch.
Yeah.
And the good instruments have soul and personality. And it's a matter of knowing how to match them with the right player.
Right.
Vice versa.
Now, how do you define a vintage guitar? Like, everybody has their definition for vintage guitar. And somebody asks you, what is a vintage guitar?
I think the word vintage is almost becoming useless because it doesn't really define a particular age. People say, well, how old does it have to be in order to be considered vintage? And I think that it's almost better these days to use the term collectible rather than vintage. When I opened up my store, a five-year-old electric Gibson or Fender could be a much, much better guitar, and actually from a completely different era than what they were doing in 1970.
Right.
1970, January, I opened. 5 years previous would be January 65. That could still be an L-series Fender that sounded real good. Even though Leo had just sold the company, they were still building guitars with pre-CVS parts. And Gibson Electrics, at the beginning of 1965, a 335 would have nickel hardware, the right body shape, a nice 1/11/16 nut, good pickups, stop tailpiece. And that today is a very desirable guitar. And in 1970, we knew that that early 65 was a whole lot better. For that matter, Martin guitars, if they were even 1 year old, they'd be Brazilian rosewood.
Right.
And they could have a Gibe case. But by 1970, you know, things were different. But in 1965, the Martin D28 would have ivoroid grained bindings. It would have genuine ivory nut and saddle. It would have a tortoise shell grain pick guard. It would have a full-length saddle, it was a very different beast, and it also came with a good case. By 1970, same model would be Indian Rosewood, lousy intonation. They didn't put the bridge in the right place in 70. And it'd be a black pickguard, it'd be a Rosewood bigger bridge plate. It really wouldn't be a very good guitar comparatively. But when I opened up my store, a 30-year-old guitar was 1940. Now a 30-year-old guitar is 1996.
Yeah, so they, and that would be considered a vintage guitar. People say, well, my 96 Squire Strat.
Well, 96 is obviously not a vintage guitar.
No,
nowhere near. A 50-year-old guitar today is as old, a 50-year-old guitar is 1976, but a 50-year-old guitar when I opened up was 1920.
Right, right.
And, you know, the electric guitar hadn't even been invented yet. And for that matter, there were no Dreadnought guitars with the Martin name on them.
Right.
It was, Martin was still making gut string guitars. Vintage is less useful these days because we'd have no idea what vintage means. Vintage usually means it has age.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of individual makers, some of the best instruments they ever made were their latest.
Right.
But for Martin, like in 1933, Martin had been in business for already 100 years.
Right.
But if you want to talk about when were the best Strombergs made, they were made late in his career. For any individual handcrafter, his best are likely to be his newest. They have more skill, more years of experience. If they're not as good as their old ones, it means they may be arthritic or getting senile or no longer give a damn. But for an individual handcrafter, his best are probably his newest.
Right.
I hardly use the term vintage anymore.
Yeah. I know that you prefer using a term called the golden era when you describe American guitars.
Well, there are golden eras for each individual maker.
Right.
Golden era for Gibson mandolins would be in the 1920s for the lore period, especially. The golden era for steel string Martins would be in the period of 1928 through late 38, when after which they went to the rear shifted bracing, and they feel very, very good, but they're not as good. They're not as sought after. To me, the 1950s for acoustics by Martin and Gibson is not a golden era.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, brand new Martins are better than what Martin made 50 or even 60 years ago. But the Martins are right now, they're better than what they made even 5 years ago. And some of the worst Martins, and Gibsons for that matter, and Fenders are from the 1970s. And those are instruments that are at this point old enough to even start having geriatric problems. In 1970, we knew that the 1930 or the 30-year-old 1940 guitar we knew would likely need a neck set, and they didn't have an adjustable rod, so it might need a plane and a refret, and you'd have to check for loose bridge, loose bracing. Well, today, 50-year-old guitars can have those same problems. But if you take a 1976 D28 that needs a neck set and a plane and refret and gluing loose braces and a loose bridge, you can have $1,500 of work. And when you get done, it's still not a really collectible guitar. And even if you fix it up to be as good as it was brand new, it's not as good as what Martin makes today. And the Gibson acoustics today are better. And for that matter, a lot of the electrics by Fender and Gibson are better now than they made 50 years ago. But keeping in mind that 50 years ago it was 1976, and that's not a golden era for them.
No, not at all.
For something like Modigliani, 1976 might be lovely, but his newest ones are still worth more.
So I think that the whole reason we have a vintage business is because these companies did end their golden era by doing whatever it was they did that made people say, I'd rather have the old one than this one, right?
That is true. And in the 70s, for a professional musician who really wanted a good sounding instrument, they just about had to buy something that was used or sometimes quite old. Sometimes they didn't even have to be very old. Like in early 1965, if you wanted to get a Gibson Firebird, That was a reverse body with the banjo type pegs and the individual routes in the body for the pickups, neck through body construction. But by after mid 65, they changed the specs completely. Ted McCarty was gone, and it didn't take very long for them to screw the things up and cut corners. And from after mid 65, the Firebird models all had the exact same neck and body. It was a glued in neck. The body was a bit thinner. It wasn't neck through. It had a big swimming pool route for the pickups. So you could put in two pickups, three pickups, one, two, you know, whatever you want. Just the pickups were attached to the pick guard, and the pickups were not really mounted direct into the body. They were simply mounted onto the guard. It wasn't the same guitar, and it wasn't as good.
Right.
But today, a lot of the new ones are good. And today, we have a situation, though, in which the new ones are quite good. And some of the real golden eras have gotten so expensive that they're collectible to the point where only rich boys can afford them. And the rich boys don't want them. They want them if they look in so-called player grade.
Right.
Now, if the player grade condition is one quarter the price of the so-called collectible condition, you know, if a 1937 Herringbone D28 can push over $200,000, if you have a player grade one that's $50,000, the collectors don't want it. And the players can't afford $50,000. You know, the sidemen don't make that kind of money. And the amateur players also don't make that kind of money. When I started out collecting, or even when I had my shop early years, there was virtually no guitar that I could not personally afford for my own collection, could afford to keep them. Now, I sometimes feel like the Rolls-Royce salesman who works at the Rolls-Royce dealership and drives a Honda, and he can't afford to drive a Rolls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to buy an Explorer that's $1 million for me to keep it. Besides, I don't even play electric, but I don't keep D45s either, because now the D45s are pushing sometimes into that six, or even if you get a really good one, it can push into seven figures.
So you mentioned these collectors that are, they draw the line. Do they draw the line on Martins when the bracing changes from scalloping to a wider bracing, or do they draw the line when the X is moved back? Where's the actual dividing line?
For some of these guys, they draw the line when the X is rear shifted, and that happened in late 38. They'll still buy one after that, but they're not as excited.
So it really does have to be early 37, 38.
38 is when the change took place, fairly late in the year. But there are still, look, if somebody finds a 1941 D45, that's still going to sell just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of these guys who are so firm into wanting only forward shifted that they don't take the time to listen that some of those rear shifted ones sound wonderful.
Can someone actually tell the difference, though, if the bracing is scalloped or not? I mean,
we're not talking about scalloped versus non-scalloped.
Right, you're talking about the bracing itself.
Forward shifted.
Right.
It comes right down to it. The scalloping ended in late 44, but they still continued using Adirondack spruce through 45. And I would say that the difference in tone between a 44 with scallop bracing and a 45 with non-scalloped bracing but still Adirondack is much less dramatic than the difference between a 45 with non-scallop bracing and a 46 with non-scallop bracing but Sitka. The 46s do not appeal to me, and they sound radically different. The difference in tone between the scalloped braced 44 and a non-scalloped 44 late in the year is negligible.
Negligible.
They were still pretty lightly braced, and it's not that easy to tell.
Did they change the bracing because of the repairs because the strings were just getting so thick that they actually were pulling the tops off?
Well, they didn't write down any of the reasons why, and the people who really know the reasons are dead. So we can speculate as to why they did it. They may have thought it was going to save them on warranty. but I really don't think they were any stronger from the change.
Probably, yeah. Now, as far as 1965 is the big line divided between Fenders and Gibsons, mainly because Gibson starts narrowing necks, they start changing to the chrome hardware. 1964, they move the Martin factory. Is there any, do you take a hit in value when you go from a 64 to a 65 because of the change in the where it was made?
Yeah, I don't think that made a radical difference in the price. But the change when they went from the Tortoise Guard to the Black Guard, those are less. The change when they went from the long saddle is also about the same time. And those tend to bring a bit less.
I believe they stopped using hide glue around then also, right?
Yeah. Hide glue gets a lot of hype, but I don't hear much difference in it. The brand new Martins that have hide glue for custom shop and getting a guitar with the identical specs with the standard glue sounds the same to my ear. They charge a lot extra for hide glue and they hype it up, but my ear doesn't tell me that it really truly makes a difference. It certainly makes a difference whether it's Adirondack or Sitka. It does make a difference whether it's a scallop braced guitar, at least on Martins, because typically it's not so much even whether it's scalloped as how heavy the bracing is.
Right.
It's possible to make a very good sounding non-scalloped brace if it's just the right dimensions. But it happens that when Martin did non-scalloped, they typically went also to heavier bracing.
Right. So one of the things, like when we talk about the birth of the vintage guitar market, in your opinion, which instruments became collectible first?
Acoustic guitars, banjos and mandolins simultaneously became more collectible. And a lot of that had to do at that time with bluegrass and some old-timey, not so much with blues players. But these things were becoming collectible even in the 1950s.
Right.
There were players who knew that the old ones were better and they were willing to pay more for them than for the new ones. Collectors like Harry West, who was in New York at that time, even in the late 1940s, was collecting. And when I started out University of Chicago in 1963, there were students there who were very keenly aware of the vintage instruments, which we called vintage then, but some of them weren't really all that old, because in 1963, even a 20-year-old guitar would be 1943.
Right.
But we were well aware that they were better. With the electric guitar players, I think one of the players who was really influential and doesn't get near as much attention is Mike Bloomfield.
Yes. They always say Clapton, but not Bloomfield.
He popularized Les Pauls. Because back when I was in college, I was primarily interested in acoustics, but when I'd go to pawn shops and music stores and looking at classified ads, for every one I wanted to keep, I'd turn up 20 or 30 that were great deals on things I didn't want, but I knew where I could flip them.
Mm-hmm.
And mommy and daddy gave me money at the beginning of each month for off-campus apartment rent and food and books, etc. I'd spend every nickel of it on guitars, and within a week, I'd have money back to pay my bills, and I could often enough afford to keep one or two. And that's what got me started in collecting. But I had just almost an addiction for them. If I hadn't gotten the one in a month, I'd have withdrawal symptoms. And later I had to have one a week. And by late 60s, I wanted to have maybe one or two a week.
Now, which guitars did Bloomfield use that everybody came in looking for?
Bloomfield started first with a Telecaster pre-CBS, and all of a sudden those things went up in value.
All Telecasters or just the slab neck from the 63-62 era?
Well, they had to be early. Yeah,
so like Blackguards as well, or was it like the one that he was using?
Blackguards too.
Yep.
Oh yeah, if you find a Blackguard, they brought money as much as $600 at a time, when that was more money than a new one. But Les Pauls weren't valuable much at all until Bloomfield started to play one. At least that was my experience in Chicago. But as soon as Bloomfield played on a 54 gold top, I got calls from people wanting those. But often enough, they'd also ask, why is it called a Les Paul? Who or what is that? They didn't even know who Les Paul was. I even had one guy call up and he asked me if I could find him a Les Paul model.
And of course, the Bloomfield, then when he switches to the Sunburst, I think those shoot up 600% in 3 years.
Those shot up within 2 weeks.
Yep.
But I still remember when I would occasionally run across a Burst and players said, well, we don't want that. Those tunematic bridges kill sustain, and the tunematic, the humbucking pickups are sickly, sweet, syrupy sounding. No, we don't want that. We need those good P90s like Mike has. But when Mike switched, all of a sudden, they couldn't remember saying anything of the sort. If they had a gold top, they'd strip the finish and route it for humbuckers and paint it Sunburst. But Bloomfield came to me and asked me to help find a Burst for him. And I knew him, but I couldn't find one as quick as Dan Earlywine got one, and he traded with Earlywine. But within a matter of 2 weeks, people who told me how the Bursts were not good and the gold tops were where it's really at, they could not recall ever having said that.
Now, you're very tone conscious. Can you tell the difference? I mean, to you, does that AB1 really kill tone the way some people say it does?
I don't think that the tunematics seem to kill tone.
Or sustain. They remove some of the earthly sustain that you get from that 55, 54 gold top.
They are different, but again, you have the situation where the pickups are different and the bridge is different. You really get a point on the older instruments where it's only one thing that changed. You know, scientific experiments like to have one variable at a time that you can change and test. But if you have too many variables changing at once, then you don't know exactly. And even when pickups change, you know, pickups, even different year pickups sound different. But I would at least say that the acoustic guitars were collectible before the electrics. And a lot of the prices on the acoustics were driven by bluegrass. And the acoustic market and the electric market were virtually separate markets with different clientele. And it wasn't until folks like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young got into folk rock and did acoustic set and electric set. And when rock and roll money got injected into the acoustic guitar market, prices went way up. And a lot of the acoustic players were unhappy because they were being outbid by rockers.
Yeah, they had no idea what was going to come further down the pike when they would go really crazy.
Well, nobody in 1970 would have imagined that an Explorer could ever be a $1 million guitar someday, or for that matter, nobody dreamed that a D45 Martin could ever push $1 million, or that herringbone D's might be 200 plus for the right ones. Nor was there that big a deal over Sunburst finish the way some folks are now willing to pay double as much for a Sunburst, which makes no difference in tone, or in Les Pauls where they pay huge premiums for curly maple when the catalog specs didn't call for that. And the catalog picture of a Sunburst Les Paul and Gibson catalog in 60 didn't show any curl at all.
Right.
If you're getting Stradivari or Guarneri violins, curl doesn't make any difference in the price. But on guitars, it doesn't make much difference on a Martin D28 herringbone, whether it has fancy grain rosewood. But if it's a Les Paul, if it has curly maple, people pay extra. So, and it doesn't make any difference on the sound. I'm not going to claim that all of that is logical.
No.
Yeah. Music is a matter of emotion and passion in a lot of respects. And expecting it all to be logical, you might be disappointed. Even in the art world, it's interesting enough how Van Gogh paintings now can be over $100 million. I don't think I'd want to have one of those hanging on the over the sofa in my living room. Even if I had armed guards around the clock, somebody might come in and shoot them in order to get the picture.
Right.
You can't even have a replica of it if it's known that you have a real one, but you don't tell everybody that the one over your sofa is a fake. They might kill you to get that, thinking it's the real one.
Right. So we had, like, so you start out in 1970, and for about the first 5 years, there's a big boom. Like, vintage guitars were appreciating about 20 to 25% per year up to about 1975. And then you claim, I think, the vintage market cooled in 1975, and you theorize...
Well, it cooled by 76.
By 76.
And that's about the time when the baby boomers were hitting age 25, and they had the expensive house, car, wife, children, upward mobility in their job. And if they came home at night, they were probably tired. But if they did take the guitar out of the case and play, it woke up the kids, which pissed off the wife, who made them put it back in the case.
Right.
And they'd quit. And that's something that had been happening for probably over 100 years, was this typical thing. People would buy a guitar at puberty and play through about 25, and then quit if they had a job.
Yeah,
if they were
to go
a professional
to work.
Musician, they continued playing, but they generally got divorced.
Right. So the market didn't bubble. The market just stopped growing and just stagnated then, would you say, for 5 years?
They didn't even keep up with inflation from 1976 through the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, something changed. And I was getting calls from 40-year-olds wanting the same type instruments that they had when they were 20, or sometimes the ones that they didn't have when they were 20 but aspired to have, and now they have money.
So this was like a midlife crisis type thing, right? A baby boomer midlife crisis.
Well, the midlife crisis is something that never happened before. It used to be people would get instruments from puberty through 20, play through 25, but maybe not buy after 20. And then upon retirement, they'd go back to playing the music that was popular when they were of dating age. And they had a mini boomlet, but only a mini boomlet, not near as big as the initial. And we'd see even Fretted Infant Guild of America in the 60s is a bunch of people who played mandolin orchestra music, and now they're retired. But that boom ended in 1921. The next boom was Dixieland. By 1970, FIGA was a bunch of Dixieland players. But after that, it kind of fizzled out, because the next fretted instrument thing would have been orchestral rhythm guitars, the big band era. And you don't do a lot of just having a bunch of guys with F-hole archtops sitting around in a group of 20 playing that way. The guitar was not that prominent in the big band era. It was a rhythm instrument in the background. But my own feeling is that the baby boom was the first generation ever to grow up with the expectation, taking for granted, that they would live to grow old. No generation before ever took that for granted. Even if you were a millionaire, you get a strep throat, you're likely to get rheumatic heart disease, you die.
Right.
You get TB, you're going to die. You get lots of different infectious diseases, you die. People didn't take for granted that they were automatically expecting to get old, and they didn't generally have a midlife crisis. And they were not buying guitars in middle age, but they did when they were baby boomers. Baby boomers had antibiotics from the day they were born. And they took for granted that not only would modern medicine keep them from dying from infectious disease at an early age, but they expected that medicine was going to keep them alive till they were about 120.
So why not get that dream guitar they wanted?
Well, the fact is, they buy guitars. Baby boomers have bought guitars of the type that they wanted when they were puberty through 20, and they still happen now, but the fact is, new guitars now are good enough that you don't have to have an old one to have something that's good enough to take on stage. Plus, even with acoustic guitars, a lot of people have a wire coming out the end pin and stomp boxes on the floor. If they got pedal boards and a wire coming out the end pin, it doesn't make so much difference whether they have a great sounding acoustic or not.
Right.
And even it doesn't make as much difference if they have a great sounding older classic electric. The other thing that's happening is that if you have an original 59 Burst and you go on stage with it, even people sitting in the front row can't tell if you have that or if you have a Gibson R9 or one of the other Gibson reissues, especially if they get one with relicking. You can't tell it. And if you're running it through a bunch of pedals, a great set of early PAFs may not work as well as EMGs. Mm-hmm. Because if you have pedals, you don't want any background hiss of any kind that goes through any loops. So sometimes a pickup that may not sound very good to my ear may work fine with a pedal board. And the other obvious factor is that most working musicians either can't afford a 59 Burst or even a Dot 335. But even if they had one, there's enough replicas that look just like it. So on stage, people don't get excited.
Right.
They get more excited, like when Billy Gibbons just had, he told me 30 some years ago, I sat down with him, he was saying how he did a show, he played on Pearly Gates, his Les Paul. And at the end of the show, he played the encore on an Explorer, an old one, the original. At the end of the show, the roadie for one of the for the opening act band came up and said, "Hey, that was a really neat guitar you had there at the end for the encore. Was that an Ibanez or was it a Hamer?" And Billy said, "No, that was my Gibson. Old Explorer." And the guy looked puzzled and said, "Gee, I didn't know they made them too." Well, That's when Billy got the idea to have guitars shaped like the state of Texas that can belch smoke at the push of a button. And guitars covered in fur and all these other things. Even Rick Nielsen used to play lots of old guitars on stage. And he switched to playing lots of goofy looking modern ones that were weird. Because in order to stand out, having a replica of an old one didn't mean as much when you can go in Guitar Center or other stores and see a wall full of things that look like that.
Right.
If you have a custom color Fender in burgundy mist, how is the audience supposed to know it's valuable when you can go to Guitar Center or any other Fender dealer and buy the same thing at not much different price from the regular? They look alike. And so a lot, some musicians want guitars that really stand out in appearance. Mm-hmm. But we're in changing demographics now.
Yeah.
The baby boomers are no longer buying much. I don't have very many customers my own age. I'll be 81 the 21st of this month. I'm still active. I'm here 6 days a week. I zip up the stairs two at a time. And I'm still buying guitars, even personally. But, you know, I realize that I don't have as many years ahead of me as behind me. And that most of the customers I have had over the years, who, if they were 40 years old when I started my business, they'd be 95 now, or actually they'd be 97. I don't have any 97-year-old customers. Some of them may still be alive, but they're not buying at age.
Well, who's buying the Martin Dreadnought, like the D28s, the nice D28s now, the pre-war? Who's coming in and buying the pre-war Martins now, if it's not so much baby bluegrass?
Generally, they're no longer bluegrass players, and they're collectors who just happen to have lots of money, and they also collect art and other stuff.
So they buy it because they know it's something valuable that they can hold on to and flip later?
Yeah, but those buyers aren't buying them to play. After all, if you get one that's in the museum-grade condition, you don't want to get a scratch on it.
Right.
So it's a different market.
And in Nashville, do a lot of the big stars come in and buy these expensive guitars?
Some do.
Do they play them?
Well, Vince does, but a lot of them, it's more collectible.
More collectible.
But, you know, I'm not seeing Keith Urban getting up on stage with expensive guitars. Garth Brooks doesn't come on stage. Garth Brooks plays Toccamini's of his own model, and his sidemen don't play expensive guitars. So, and you can get guitars that don't cost a whole lot that on stage work quite well now, which is not really so much the case back in 1970. In 1970, to get good sound, you pretty well had to get something old. These days, instead of buying a more expensive guitar, folks go out and buy more pedals. You know, I have a somewhat cynical view of the world, but it's not as easy as it used to be. I can't support a business the size that I have on vintage instruments alone, on collectible alone.
Mm-hmm.
They're too hard to get. And when we can get them often enough, it's consignment at a low commission rather than owning it, which is owning is more profitable. But the number of guitars also that fit in that category, with some of these guys who claim to be collectors, I'd say they're maybe more speculators than really collectors. If they're concentrating only on half a dozen models and buying multiples of the same thing, that's not the same.
In 1985, we talk about the 1985 surge. A lot of money came from Japan because the U.S. dollar weakened. How did that change? Did that really, all of a sudden, did that cause prices to skyrocket?
It didn't come in 1985 because the dollar weakened. Besides, the Japanese were buying heavily in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese, even by 79, 40% of my business was export.
So it was already before the 80s even started then?
The Japanese buyers were there as early as 1970 when I opened up. They discovered me pretty quickly. That happened afterward from 76 through 85. It was slow, but the Japanese did keep me going. They kept me going better than the Americans did. And the reason that they could do that, one, is that they had money. Actually, there were wealthy Japanese buyers doing it. The import regulations were quite lax. There was no problem with the CITES Treaty Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species. Filling out the paperwork to export one would take 5 minutes. Now, some of this stuff is months worth of effort, and if there's any ivory on it, you can't get a permit at all. And for Brazilian rosewood, you jump through a whole bunch of hoops and hurdles to get the paperwork. It's even difficult to travel across international borders if you're a musician and have anything that has ivory, and in some cases, even Brazilian rosewood. It's erratic in its enforcement for travelers, but it's not erratic for shipping. Shipping, if you don't have the right paperwork, it's likely to get confiscated. You'll get fined and you'll lose the instrument. So that's the way it is.
Today, you've been in this business for so long. What guitars in the early days were nobody cared about, but now are worth fortunes today? Are there some guitars that you just had to, you just didn't know it, and now some they're worth fortunes today? I guess the Explorer would be one.
No, I'd say that's not really so true. The Explorer was ignored when it was made. But by 1970, it wasn't ignored. I could get more money for an Explorer in 70 than I could for a Burst.
Even then, people knew how rare it was.
Absolutely. People knew in 1970. Interest was already there. The instruments that were valuable in 70 are the same ones that are valuable now, except they bring more money now. And now, in many ways, some of the ones that were valued in 70 are less interesting to a lot of the buyers who want to specialize in only half a dozen instruments. Like D'Angelico's and Strombergs don't bring as much money as they used to. And I'm not even talking inflation adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
Like a good cutaway Master 400 Stromberg could bring $80,000 in 1990. He'd be lucky to get 50 for it now. It'd be a struggle. So D'Angelico's don't bring as much as I used to be able to get for them. F5 mandolins got into a bit of a bubble around 2006, early 07. They're bringing less now than they did then, but they're still bringing over 100,000 for a good lore. But they were bringing 200. So
in 1970, did people care if it was a 58, 59, or 1960 burst? Or were they just any burst? Or when did the 1959 become the one that everybody had to have?
Well, they knew perfectly well that any sunburst Les Paul was valuable in 70. But valuable is a relative term. They were bringing $800 to $1,000. And there wasn't that much difference in the price. And at least by the mid-70s, it was pretty evident that people really, really wanted a 59. And I think that they get, and also they were just fanatically into curly grain, which curly grain does not make the guitar better. But most of them, you know, really highly figured is no more than 10% of the total of them. Gibson didn't select it because it was random. They book matched the top, but they didn't seem to care whether it was curly or not. So that's just the way it is. But it has become fashionable, though, to want only a very few models. Some makers who are very good, like, for example, Larson Brothers in Chicago, made marvelous acoustic guitars. And I find them much harder to sell now than it would have been 30 years ago. Not enough people seem to know about them. Or the ones who do want to invest only want super, super primo, things that are so hard to find that it's hard to base a business on them. And if it's not one of the super primo models in beautiful condition, many of those collectors just flat out don't want them. And the player grade has become, of some of those models, still too expensive for most players. It leaves, we're in a transition time. We're in a time when the Japanese market is weak because the Japanese economy is weak and because the export regulations are very difficult to comply with. It's difficult to even bring in an American-made instrument that gets over in Europe or Japan and get it back. If it has ivory anywhere on it, you can't get a permit for it. If it has Brazilian rosewood, you can get a permit. If it's made before June 11th of 1992, you can get a permit, but it may take you several months to get the permit. And as far as shipping something to the UK or to Germany, the regulations have gotten so onerous even on Brazilian rosewood, they don't honor the permits. And or they'll want, the CITES treaty requires an export permit, but doesn't specify that you have to have a matching import license from your country. But the UK and Germany are doing that, and they've given people a real hard time on that. So there's just numerous factors going into it, making the world confusing today.
You used to, I know a lot of your writings and stuff, you always said, you know, the baby boomers are what makes this vintage guitar business. Like, it's us baby boomers. And now that the baby boomers are aging out.
Baby boomers are no longer in charge.
So the baby boomers are no longer, in fact, many of the dealers we know, they're being inundated with people coming, the baby boomer generation selling their collections back in, you know, trying to sell those things now. Or their families are trying to.
I am not inundated with really great collectibles from baby boomers where I'm just being flooded with them. I think there's more of that perhaps in the East Coast and West Coast, but a lot of that stuff didn't get sold in the middle of the country. And some of those baby boomers who are downsizing go to their local dealer that they know, and that means that they still stay on the East Coast or the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But I am not being inundated with huge numbers of really primo vintage. We struggle to get enough.
Most of the stuff that comes in now, you say, is on consignment, would you say?
It varies. we get, if they're priced where we can buy them, we buy them. But it's hard to get customers with those who want to sell them except on consignment, because they're aware that they can get more money that way. If the sellers are knowledgeable about what they have and they realize it's just like selling a house, you can use a realtor and they get a commission. But if the realtor is going to cut you a check same day, it's going to be considerably less. They'd rather wait.
Right. Right. So we already talked about that. Electrics and acoustics kind of were used to fall in the original days, followed a different demographic path. Is that happening again today, or people buying both that collect both?
Most buy one or the other. A few buy both. But the back in the 60s, it was two completely separate markets. And then starting 69 through 75, those markets merged, but a lot of it was rock money getting invested into the acoustic market. And now it's, frankly, I think the market's in a bit of turmoil at this point. And trying to make long-term predictions is difficult. Or as Yogi Berra might have said, it's hard to make predictions because it's about the future and it hasn't happened yet. And a lot of things have been pretty unpredictable. And where it's going to go from here is far less than certain.
Do you think the market today is too obsessed with condition?
Well, I think some of the people are too obsessed with things like if it's had a bridge plate replaced. If we do a bridge plate, we can do it right. If something, they worried about if it has original frets or not. Worn out frets are not original spec. If we refret one, we can do it well. And if the only thing that repair work could do would be to devalue instruments, I could free up 6,000 square feet of space and get rid of 10 people.
We talk now that this stuff is now maintenance. It's no longer neck resets, refretting. That's just maintenance on an 80, 90-year-old acoustic guitar.
It is if you know how to do it right.
And it must be done right, or it's not.
If it's not done right, you're really in trouble. Unskilled repair can greatly devalue an instrument. Fully half, if not more, of the work we do upstairs in our repair shop is undoing previous botched amateur repairs. Or not even amateur sometimes, it's people who had a reputation as being good in their day, but by today's standards were butchers.
With electric guitars, are you finding that many of the guitars have to have pickups rewound now?
No, I'm not finding that. I mean, you certainly find some, particularly Fenders, but no, the majority don't.
How much do you think it devalues to have the pickups rewound?
It definitely devalues it, and so far as trying to put a percentage on, it depends on the value of the guitar but and how fussy the buyer is. But frankly, there are people who can do a very, very good job on it, but you have to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. I'm told that the people that do it now do it much better than the way they were done originally sometimes.
Yeah, well, I think that at this point, it's getting unreasonably demanding to think that everything has to be perfect. People are paying $15 million plus for Stradivari and Guarneri violins, and every one of them has been highly reworked. Mm-hmm. They're all hot rodded from their original specs, even to make them play to symphonic standards today and to be tunable to A440. To be able to play modern symphonic music, you have to modify them. And you don't have to do that on the guitars, but more and more people are willing to accept extremely good repair. But repairmen are not all created equal, and a lot of them really aren't very good.
That's why when you have something done, you have it done at a place like your place, which is sometimes part of the consignment, right? They bring it in.
But fully, I'd say at least 80% of the repair work that we do is for instruments that we either own or are on consignment. We really don't have the capacity to do everybody's public repairs. But if it's on consignment, we'll work on it. If we own it, we'll work on it. And Otherwise, we typically refer them elsewhere because we just can't, we don't have the capacity to do it all.
How hard is it today to authenticate guitars? Is it getting more difficult, or is it now you've done it for so long, you know exactly what to see, what to look for?
Well, the quality of the forgeries keeps getting better as the prices go up. So when a Explorer was $1,000 or $1,200, I didn't see any convincing fakes. But now we see very convincing fakes. But we do have the ability these days to do forensic testing. So, for example, the company Vintage Verified here in Nashville does that sort of work, and they are very good at it. Things that we cannot see with the human eye, they can see with the equipment, but they have several hundred thousand dollars of test equipment, so they can see how many layers of lacquer are there. They can tell what composition the lacquer is in many cases. They can tell which manufacturer made it and in which decade. Mm-hmm. And that is helpful, but it also opens up a Pandora's box, because the skilled enough forgeries that might have gotten past dealers who may be reputable dealers are likely now, upon testing, to be, some of them turn out not to be what they were represented as.
Right. And that could have happened 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
Oh, it could have happened 50 years ago. And it's just like the art world. A lot of museums are checking their collections, and some of them just ain't real. Sotheby's had to refund $80 million on a Sunflower Van Gogh painting because it wasn't really Van Gogh, because its pigments were things that didn't exist in his lifetime so far as the chemistry. The colors looked right, the technique looked right, but it tested wrong. And we had a case where we did an appraisal recently on a guitar that had been sold for over $100,000, a surf green Stratocaster, and Vintage Verified tested it instead of Duco from the 60s. The lacquer was Mohawk, of a formula that was only used in the 70s and 80s. The quality of the finish looked perfect, but it wasn't real. And that kind of thing, more and more, I would say now the ability to analyze for originality is better now than it's ever been. But sometimes that's a double-edged sword for some dealers.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's like, you know, people ask me in the price guide, you know, real custom colored fenders that are like, you have provenance, you have pictures. They now go for 3 to 4 times the price of a standard finish.
Because, well, we can tell with or without that provenance whether it's real.
Yes, you could tell.
At this point, yeah, we can tell. It's not just eyeballing it. Mm-hmm. Our eyeballs are rather skilled, but now it's backed up with a few $100,000 of test equipment that can tell you a tremendous amount more.
Right.
You know, we can X-ray them. We can CAT scan them. We can analyze the finish. We can analyze the metal and plastic. So even when you have plastic components that are replicas, we can tell.
Mm-hmm. No more just a black light test. This is actually...
No, that's primitive.
You know, people are using spectrometers. And
we're talking about way more. You can get a black light sheet. Some of these individual pieces of equipment are as much as $300,000.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, that's why, you know, like I say, when I buy something, I know where to go to know that it's the right thing. It's the proper thing. And that's why I buy at Grund. You know, that's why I bought my OM28 there. So that's how it is.
You know, I'll never claim to be completely omniscient or infallible.
Yeah.
But in all the years I've been in business, I've only been threatened with a lawsuit over something that we inadvertently thought was real when it wasn't. And we've had one such case in over 57 years. Now, that doesn't mean that we never made a mistake before, but it hasn't come back to bite us.
Right, right.
But I did have one dealer in New York tell me, when I was telling him over 25 years ago that I'm having trouble with these custom color fenders, that they're getting better and better. And he says, George, what's the matter with you? You're getting older, losing confidence. Like, I don't ever have any trouble looking at them. I can always tell. I've never been fooled by one. There's something sort of fundamentally wrong with that statement. It may not have come back to bite him, but how would he know if he'd never been fooled? If it doesn't come back to bite you, you don't know. And Tom Murphy, I told him that same story, and he says, yeah, one time he went to a guitar show, and he saw a Candy Apple Red Strat, and he had a friend who wanted one, and he looked at it. He didn't have time at a guitar show to take it all apart and whatever, but he said he knows enough about, you know, Murphy is the finished guy. He would know. So he bought it at a price that was not ridiculous low, but a decent deal. He took it home, and his pots were a little scratchy, so he decided he'd clean them. He lifted the pick guard, and there was a name scratched into the finish under the guard. What would be the most ironic possible?
I don't know.
It was signed by Tom Murphy, the way he signs when he does a refinish. He had refinished the thing a few years previous, and it had some real wear. And anyway, his own job fooled him. And, you know, the quality of finish used to be, when I started out, you could tell if it was refinished, it looked like barn paint applied with a broom. But there was not much in the way of really quality refinishing. Now there is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Explorers were $1,200, there were no convincing fakes. When they got to $30,000, there were some that looked a little more like it. And when they got to $50,000 and $100,000, and now with $1 million, you better believe that there's... Even with sunburst Les Pauls, there seemed to be more of them out there than there were ever made. And even in that Beauty of the Burst book, with testing, some of them now have been exposed as not real.
Interesting. Very interesting.
But it's in the art world, it's a similar thing. A lot of museums are testing, finding that some of their collection is not real. And a lot of universities that had received donations of artwork, previous to even World War II, from people who were collectors who sincerely believed that they bought real ones, they were taken. So that's things that can happen. Anyway, that's the scoop.
Well, I thank you so much. This was a great, I took a lot. I took a whole hour of your time, and I appreciate it. I really wanted to do this.
If you have questions, we can do another session.
Yeah, no, this is perfect. I really wanted just to talk about, since 1970, a lot has happened, and you've been at the forefront of it.
Look, the 70s were some of the worst stuff ever made in American guitar making history. Unless it was somebody like DeQuisto, where his stuff was good, or Monteleone. So it depends who it was to say that there's one period that's golden. Well, the golden period for Gibson mandolins was in the 20s, but their golden period for their banjos was in the 30s. Their golden period for acoustic flat tops was in the 30s. That was their very best. Their golden period for electrics was in the 50s. So...
Right.
You know, even for individual makers who've been in business for a long time, they may have different golden periods. The golden period for gut string Martins was before 1920. But for steel string Martins, I think their absolute golden period is 1928 through late 38. But the new ones are some of the best made since World War II. And they're better than the ones made during World War II in many cases. So... golden era has to be, you have to define what it is, what's the product. Some of these companies have diversified models and have a long history, so they may have ups and downs over that course of history. Anyway, you got plenty to munch on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Bye.
I'll see you again. I'll be in Nashville soon, and who knows what I'll bring home the next time I see you.
All righty.
Anyways, thank you again. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. Please support VG for all they do for guitar players like us. Please subscribe, like, share, and comment on this podcast. I'd love to hear from you at ram@vintageguitar.com. See you again next week. Bye-bye.
The official Vintage Guitar Magazine price guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.